I think in a lot of ways this may be the only vote that, you know, in my time here that will be this significant.
Alaska's Democratic Senator talks about the health care bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 21st of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage has a new police chief.
I've got a few ideas, but I want to hear what others have to say. I think the first thing I want to do is report for duty, start talking to the folks who work there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Senate took a key vote on health care legislation early this morning that sets up passage of the bill on Christmas Eve. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
All 100 senators showed up for Monday morning's dead of night vote, despite a blizzard that left much of the Capitol snowed in. Just after 1 a.m., Democrats got the 60 votes needed to shut down a Republican filibuster and move forward. Alaska senators split their votes along party lines, with Senator Mark Begich joining Democrats and Senator Lisa Murkowski among the 40 Republicans fighting the bill. Senator Begich says even though there are still more votes to come on the health care legislation, Monday morning's was the big one.
Because it showed and put on the record the 60 votes, but also when you think about this legislation, it will have a dramatic impact to Alaskans and Americans not only today but for decades to come. And I think in a lot of ways this may be the only vote that, you know, in my time here that will be this significant.
Begich says the bill will affect a sixth of the economy, ensure 31 million more Americans, and ban insurance companies from practices like denying patients coverage because of pre-existing conditions. The senator says he's not concerned with recent polls showing more Americans are against the bill than for it. The latest by CNN shows 56% of Americans oppose the Senate's health care bill, while 42% support it. The numbers actually show an increase in approval for the bill from earlier this month, but Begich says that's not what's guiding him.
You know, you'll hear from the other side, well, you know, the sky's going to fall now, the world's going to come apart, the polls aren't with you. Well, you know, if we measured everything by poll data here, and it seems like the Republicans like to do that now, we wouldn't do anything because everyone's scared of their own shadow around here. And the reality is when they passed Medicare, the polls were only about 30% supportive. 30%. Now, I guarantee you if tomorrow we said we're getting rid of Medicare, the sky would cave in here. I mean, this place would be run over.
Begich says a manager's amendment being added to the bill has numerous items for Alaska. It includes the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, legislation Alaska's senators have pushed. Now it will be rolled into the larger bill and includes reauthorization of all current Indian health care programs, establishes mental and behavioral health programs in Indian country, and improves Native youth suicide prevention programs. Begich says it now has a better chance of becoming law.
There's a couple of us, literally last week, that was told this was not going to be included. We argued pretty aggressively why it was the right thing to put in now. It made sense, and it got in, which I think is a huge step.
The health care bill jumped forward over the weekend because of deal brokering among Democrats, such as Nebraska's conservative Senator Ben Nelson. He got tighter restrictions on abortion coverage and special treatment for his state to help cover the cost of Medicaid. Begich says Alaska also got some of its priorities taken care of over the weekend.
Providing and trying to get more physicians, both docs and nurses and physician assistants, was a huge piece to this equation. How do you go after that? That's what we heard in Alaska, that we don't have enough. So I offered an amendment that moved the loan forgiveness from $35,000 to $50,000. It's estimated that piece by itself with some other little tweaks within the legislation is the big number you hear about, the 20,000 primary care physician assistant nurses. That little clause in there is pretty significant in the impact it's going to have in delivery.
There are some things Begich pushed for that did not make it in. He wanted more done to lower the price of prescription drugs, like allowing their import from some foreign countries and making Medicare purchase drugs on a competitive basis and provide rebates. Senator Lisa Murkowski warns that not enough has been done to get more doctors to take Medicare patients in Alaska, and Republicans are continuing to rail against the $871 billion bill. But Democrats now have the votes to march the legislation forward and pass the Senate. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Tomorrow, we'll hear Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski's opinion of the Democratic health care bill. A researcher who said he wanted to get a fish-eye view of whether it helps or hurts fish stocks to parcel out quotas in shares got mixed results when he studied 15 different fisheries. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
They have changed the names repeatedly. Quota shares have been called limited entry, IFQ, CDQ, LAPP, ITQ, processor quotas, DAP, and a lot of names you wouldn't want to use on the radio by some Alaska fishermen. They're used to decide who gets to fish and how much. The fishermen's problems have rarely been about the health of the fish stocks themselves, but have mostly involved things like prices, big economic changes that have hit coastal communities because of different fishing patterns, and how ownership of quota shares tends to head toward Seattle as time goes on. Under the Obama administration, quotas are being pushed as a way to get a handle on overfishing. The idea is that if fishing interests are no longer fighting over who gets the fish, there will be less of an incentive for overfishing. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has a catch share proposal out for public comment now. University of Washington researcher Tim Essington says his studies show that quota shares have not resulted in there being more fish to catch. By themselves, they wouldn't do the job. Essington studied 15 fisheries, either compared to similar ones with no quota shares or before and after the system was implemented. He looked at indicators such as total biomass, how much of the biomass was harvested, landings, and a suite of other measurements.
Across all the indicators that we looked at, there was no change in the average levels following catch share implementation. However, we did find that the catch shares did behave quite a bit differently in that they became a lot less variable from year to year.
The 15 fisheries he studied were located in the U.S. and Canada. He speculates that one reason why there is no improvement from what he called the fish-eye view of the ecosystem is that managers were already setting harvest goals at the maximum sustained yield.
One of the conclusions from this paper was that one of the reasons why we didn't see a large shift in these measures of population status was because they were pretty close to the goal anyways.
The study came out mixed on the question of whether quota shares reduced destructive fishing practices. He measured no less degradation of habitat in the quota share fisheries, but he did see a reduction in bycatch of unwanted species. So some goals of managers were accomplished by the quotas.
Primary benefit from catch shares in these fisheries was to make the fisheries more stable and more consistent from year to year, and that they did not lead to widespread improvements in ecological status.
Essington stressed that his study concentrated on what was under the water and did not look at onshore effects of quota shares. That's where most of the controversy is in Alaska. The NOAA plan out for public comment lists, quote, vibrant working waterfronts as one of its goals. A number of marine conservation organizations are pushing quota shares now. The Lenfest Ocean Program, which funded Essington's work, has taken a more distanced approach, but is administered by the Pew Environment Group. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The crew of a crippled freighter adrift in the North Pacific has repaired its engines, and the vessel is on its way to Portland, Oregon. The Coast Guard says the crew of the India-flagged vessel informed them of the repairs this morning. A Coast Guard cutter and a private boat heading to the ship, about 570 miles south of Alaska's Adak Island, were called off. The Coast Guard says it will be in radio contact with the ship until it moors in Portland. No injuries were reported among the crew of 28, and the 740-foot bulk cargo ship never took on water. Waves were reported up to 30 feet while the ship was adrift. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tapping into Kodiak's facial hair potential.
There's some great people here with beards wandering around. You know, you see them everywhere.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. If you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan has selected the city's new police chief. The mayor announced today that Mark Mew will take over as the Anchorage Police Department chief next month. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
While the rank may be new, the mayor's police chief selection will find the uniform familiar.
It's my pleasure today to announce the selection of our new chief of police, Mr. Mark Mew, who is no stranger, I think, to anyone in this room, having served as deputy chief in the department in the past and for the last 6 years as the head of security for the Anchorage School District.
Mew became an Anchorage patrol officer in 1983. He rose through the ranks to deputy chief from 1997 to 2000, then acting chief in 2001, and finally deputy chief of administration from 2001 through 2003. He then left APD to become the school district's director of security and emergency preparedness. In recent months, it was Mew who oversaw the district's response to the H1N1 outbreak and set up its inoculation program. Mew emerged as one of three finalists from about three dozen applications. In his acceptance, Mew strove first to assure the community it had a good police force, but said he hopes to make some improvements.
I don't want to be specific right now. I've got a few ideas, but I want to hear what others have to say. I think the first thing I want to do is report for duty, start talking to the folks who work there, have that discussion first. We have a great department. I'm not coming from the position that something's broken that needs drastic, immediate fixing. I think there's no doubt that we're going to be thinking a little bit more about community policing, how much of that we do and how soon we do it. I think there's still some more discussion there.
While not reducing street officers, Mayor Sullivan has cited a municipal budget gap as precluding any immediate training academies for new police hires. Mew was asked if he saw maintaining the status quo for staff levels as a problem.
Well, right now my sense is we're not in a growth mode, and a lot of that, what I would ideally like to have, is probably not achievable right now because we're frankly in kind of a bind right now. I think our immediate concern is how to deliver the most service we can with what the numbers are, with the balanced budget it says we're going to have to work with.
Mew succeeds former Chief Rob Hune, who resigned in mid-August. For KSKA, this is Len Anderson.
The success of Kodiak Electric Association's wind and hydroelectric plants has made Kodiak a state leader in the production of renewable energy. The utility cooperative plans to continue developing more sources to make the island energy efficient. But as KMXT's Diana Gish reports, they're not ready to adopt another new technology quite yet.
Simply put, capturing tidal and wave energy involves using the equivalent of underwater windmills. And though someday it may become the wave of the future, for now tidal and wave energy research has been shelved by KEA's board of directors. During their last regular meeting, the board chose not to pursue a tidal energy study with the Electric Power Research Institute. Board Chairman Cliff Davidson explained.
While we certainly are interested in keeping our finger on the pulse and keeping abreast of developments, when we think there's some technological breakthroughs and it gets closer to reality, then we're certainly probably spend some money to study things.
Kodiak Electric CEO Darren Scott said the study would have cost around $35,000.
And we're all really excited about it. We'd like to see it get a little bit more commercial first before we take a further plunge into it.
The Electric Power Research Institute, or EPRI, is located in Palo Alto, California, and carries out research and development for the electric utility industry. The Institute's ocean energy leader is Roger Bedard.
And about 6 years ago, many of the states have renewable portfolio standards, and the only options they had to meet them were basically wind, wind, and wind. So for the coastal states, I said, hey, you know, why don't we take a look at you know, what, bring in the UK technology on wave energy conversion, which they've been developing to the last, for the last 10 years, to the U.S.
Bedard calls Alaska the ocean energy state, but the small number of customers in coastal areas means fewer people to share the expense of adopting new power generation technology. Still, Bedard points out that the high cost of flying fuel into remote locations is a strong motivation for looking to the ocean for energy. In the village of Yakutak, where energy now costs 50 cents a kilowatt hour, leaders have decided it's worth the expense. This month, a year-long wave energy feasibility study was completed for the village of just under 600 residents. The cost of the study? Around $40,000. Now that the study is completed, Yakutak is looking to move from the feasibility study to the design and construction phase. The power company has applied for grants from the Alaska Renewable Energy Fund to create a pilot wave energy project. I'm Diana Gish.
The city of Skagway has a new system in place to protect the small boat harbor from wave damage. From member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell reports.
Skagway's latest harbor improvement, the wave barrier, is complete. The new harbor breakwater is a vertical barrier that actually stops short of the seafloor. It still provides the protection of a traditional rebel mound breakwater, but minimizes the footprint of the structure. Matt O'Boyle is the Skagway Harbor Master.
The wave barrier is to protect the boats and the floats inside the small boat harbor. Right now, the A float out there towards the entrance has taken quite a beating, and we've had to do quite a few repairs to that float. This wave barrier is going to alleviate the wave action that actually comes in through the entrance of the harbor.
The formation, which is known as a partially penetrating wave barrier, is a choice that is used in rough marine environments or harbors with troublesome features like dynamic wave loads, poor soils, intense sedimentation, deep water, corrosion, or sensitive ecosystems. This type of harbor protection has also been considered in areas that are subject to extremely variable tides, heavy seas, ice, earthquakes, and shoreline movement.
It looks like it's doing a really good job of protecting the harbor. We've had quite a few storms in the past that have caused quite a bit of damage to the small boat harbor, to the boats, and so this is pretty exciting to see how well it's doing.
PND, the engineers behind the design, built its first wave barrier in 1980 in Oregon. That one still withstands stormy waves, and more have been built in the meantime in Seattle, Blaine, and Ilwaco, Washington, and closer to home in Whittier and Ketchikan. Proponents of the style say it takes less time and money to build and less space when built. It minimizes impact of the marine environment by allowing natural basin flushing and lessening load on submarine soils. The barrier can be moved and added to after construction and provide mooring. And there's something in it for the landlubbers, too, with a promenade that's open to the public.
Year-round, it's going to be a really nice viewing platform.
The wave barrier's finishing touches are expected to be complete this week when the project is handed over to the Skagway Borough. In Skagway, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. Pennair, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. The Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, creating sustainable solutions to support the quality of life for communities. Information online at uskh.com. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
In a chilly, damp, and windy location like Kodiak, facial hair is far more common than elsewhere, even in the icy Arctic. But nobody from the island has ever won the Mr. Furface State Championships. KMXT's Jay Barrett has the story.
Each year at the Miners and Trappers Ball during Anchorage's Fur Rendezvous, a Mr. Furface is selected for having the best facial hair in the state. Only one man has ever competed from Kodiak, and sadly he didn't win. But Crystal White, the secretary for the Miners and Trappers Board, was in town last week trying to change that and encourage at least some of the fur-faced men in Kodiak to think about competing.
We have not had anyone from Kodiak to win yet, so we want some people to come out and give us some competition. And they do have some people coming in from Valdez this year to compete, and so they were hoping that people would step up here in Kodiak.
She said about 300 people compete in the annual event. Judy Kidder of Kodiak was one of the judges at last year's Mr. Fur Face and the World Beard and Mustache Championships, which were held in Anchorage for the first time earlier this year.
It was a riot. It was just such a blast. You never saw anything like it. They even have a category for bearded women. So these women, they all made these fake beards and everything else, and they paraded up through there. It was a special category, and it was just so much fun. You know, it's just such a great opportunity for everybody to get together and have a lot of fun, and I figured we could have a contest with the full beards, mustaches, and then a fake beards, a ptarmigan contest, and a lot of fun. Bring your friends, and, you know, we could have a judging panel where, you know, the louder the crowd is, you know, the more points they score. So, you know, it would be a fun event for Kodiak, as well as a chance for the winner to compete in the Alaska Mr. Fur Face contest.
Active in the local Lions Club, Kidder was set to organize a beard and mustache competition here last winter, but it was too short a notice to get all the details in place. This year, though, there's over 2 months to get it organized.
So we have the format ready to go, and I have a poster all prepared and everything, and I just need some sponsors for some prizes, a venue, and a time, and we can get somebody. There's some great people here with beards wandering around. You know, you see them everywhere. And I was up there judging the World Championships, and they had a new category called the Alaskan Whaler, and I see so many of those around Kodiak that somebody from here would be a shoo-in to at least claim some of the prizes in the categories at Ferrandi and the Miners and Trappers Ball.
The Alaskan Whaler beard resembles Captain Ahab's in the movie Moby Dick with Gregory Peck. White says the Mr. Furface competition this winter will be on March 6th, right on the cusp between Anchorage's two big winter activities, the Fur Rendezvous and the start of the Iditarod. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
An Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist was called to Tenneke Springs last week to free a bear whose toes had become caught in an otter trap. The cub was caught in a trap on a rocky point in Long Bay, about 15 miles northwest of Tenneke Springs. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Fish and Game biologist Laverne Beyer was dispatched along with trapper Uriah Strong to free the cub. Beyer picks up the story from there.
This bear found a cave. Well, the more noise it went on, the bear got deeper and deeper into the cave. So all I could really see was the bottom of the bear's foot because it was back in this dark cave, right? And here this full plane is kind of taxiing around, making lots of racket.
In order for Beyer to immobilize the bear, he had to literally take a shot in the dark.
He was not tangled up, not at all. He was just back deep in this black hole. So anyway, my first dart, you know, I shot in there. And I wasn't really, you know, because it was just a black hole, shoot. And it didn't come flying out. And so I started to mix up a second, prepare another second dart. And I told Uriah, okay, you just watch to see if he gets limp or the limb gets limp.
The second shot did the trick. And with the cub immobile, Beyer freed its foot, tagged its ear, and took some hair and tissue samples. The whole operation took about 2 hours. Beyer says this particular cub was probably just combing the beach looking for food. It's possible, given its young age, that it didn't know how to den up or had been abandoned by its mother. But Beyer says it's all speculation as to why this particular bear wasn't hibernating.
We generally figure that by the 8th of November, somewhere around there, the first week of November, that 99.9% of the bears are denned up. But it's not hard and fast. It's not like, you know, those swallows returning to Capistrano.
Beyer and Strong didn't stick around to see what the bear did next. The likeliest scenario is that he woke up and went on his way. Beyer says the only way to know for sure what the bear does is to wait until Strong checks his traps again. Reporting from Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
This time of year, there's no end to the stories involving reindeer. One urban legend making the rounds recently notes that all the reindeer pulling Santa Claus's sled are female. Ellen Lockyer tells us more.
Word has it, email word, I should say, that the very fact that Santa's reindeer team is sporting antlers proves that they are female reindeer. Why? because male reindeer shed their antlers in fall, and females shed theirs in spring. So the reasoning is that in December, any reindeer with headgear is a girl reindeer. And the punchline is, of course, that only strong females could haul a fat little guy all around the world in 24 hours. I hate to dash cold water on that theory, not the fat little guy part, just the all-female reindeer part. But people in the know says, tain't so. Bob Toby is a wildlife biologist with the State Department of Fish and Game in Glen Allen. He's seen his fair share of caribou.
We get them coming through. We got a herd of about 35,000.
Caribou and reindeer are exactly the same species, according to Fish and Game. In Europe, they are all called reindeer. In Alaska and Canada, only domesticated caribou are referred to as reindeer. So that clears that up. Getting back to the antlers, Toby says there is only a little bit of truth to the claim that all males shed their antlers at the same time.
The larger bulls will often shed their antlers before Christmas. The ones that are predominantly the adult, mature bulls start losing their antlers in November. But it's a gradual process. Some lose them before others. And the majority of the young bulls keep them through till the middle of the winter. So a lot of the young bulls still have their antlers at Christmas time.
So Santa's team could very well be young males, or maybe a mix of male and female. Wrong. Again, female reindeer shed their antlers after spring calving. That is true. But few females sport the magnificent racks that males do at any time of year.
The antlers on a female are real small, very light and very small.
So there you have it. Santa's A-team is more than likely juvenile males. The question remains as to why reindeer have antlers at all. Biologists have a few theories.
It's a visual dominance type thing, and it allows to cut back on the fighting because the antler display will set up dominance for the males and it lets them avoid fighting unless they're two of equal rank.
Now, as to whether or not reindeer can fly, well, that's best left to the imagination. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett and Diana Gish in Kodiak, Tara Bicknell in Haines, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron and Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the new AT&T, your world delivered. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. Attention hunters, you must apply now for all drawing hunts and for all Tier 1 and Tier 2 hunts in 2010 and in 2011. There is no application period in the spring of 2010. Be sure to tell hunters they can apply online until December 31st. Information online at wildlife.alaska.gov or 1-907-267-2257. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.